The first thing I want to talk about is some comments for getting ready for your lab report number two, because I'm working through grading your lab report number one. And morning section, even though I talked and talked and talked and talked, forgot to talk about the lab report, so I thought I'd do it for everybody at once. So most of your first lab reports only have some minor problems. The one major minor problem is about the percent composition that you came up with. And I purposely didn't address this in class because I wanted to see if you would look at your data and grapple with it a little bit. And I'm referring to two scenarios that many of you came up with, which is the case of adding up your percentages and they're less than 100%, or adding up your percentages and they're more than 100%. Because how could you have a mixture that's only 20% one compound and 30% another? What about the other 50% of that compound? Is it correct then to only report that you have recovered 20 and 30% as your composition? No, not really. And what really you needed to do then is, instead of dividing by your total original mass each time, you needed to divide by the total mass of what you really did to recover. Or at the very least, you needed to comment and say, these percentages don't make sense since they don't add up to 100%. If your percentages added up to more than 100%, again, that's not even physically possible. And if you didn't say one word about it, are you really analyzing your data? If you had more than 100%, it's because you likely had water or solvent that was still hanging around with your compound. In either of those two scenarios, if you even just mentioned something about the percentages, that was good enough. If you didn't say a word, it was one point off. So it's not like you failed your lab report if you didn't discuss it. But it's just a one-point reminder that you should try to really analyze what you got out. Now, you might say, wait, that's not fair, you didn't warn us. But you have been through a year of chemistry, and hopefully you've been talked about by somebody in the past about making sure that your data or your results make sense. More than 100% does not make sense, and so you need to comment on it. Now, for the TLC lab report, there won't be any gotchas like that. The only gotcha is that now that we've done the stain and some of you do have colors, you might be even more confused about what you have in your products. Because several of you came up and said, I've got this purple stain in my product that I don't see in any of my reference compounds. Or I have this yellow stain. Or I thought I only had one compound, but the stains are two different colors, so now I think I got two different compounds. It is very likely, very possible, there may be things in your unknowns that you can't identify, and it's perfectly fine to say as much. That based on your reference compounds, you could not identify all of your spots. And if I didn't give you enough reference compounds to be able to identify them, there's no way you'll lose credit, as long as you just make sure to say not all of the compounds could be identified. So I'm just warning you ahead of time, that's the type of thing that you need to put in to show me that you're thinking about your data. Now back to lab report one, the even more minor problems I saw. Some of you are using first-person language, which I had asked that we only do third-person lab reports. So if you say I or we, not proper style for a formal report. You need to change everything to boring third-person. So just do remember to keep on doing that. A few of you had a mismatch between your purpose and your conclusion statements. So most of you got around in your conclusion to saying that you had X percent of this and that in mixture A and X percent that and that in mixture B. But some of you didn't say that obtaining that composition was the purpose of your experiment. You just focused on the fact that you did an extraction, did a melting point, and did a percent error. But never in your purpose statement mention the composition. So if you don't mention composition in your purpose statement, why are you showing it in your conclusion? The point I'm trying to make is just make sure you do have that parallelism going on. One other, the least frequent problem I think I saw was that in a lab like this where we did have multiple calculations, I really only want to see the work for those calculations once. If you repeat the equations over and over and over again, you're filling up paper without showing me anything useful. Once I know you did it correctly once, I can tell if you did it correctly the other times. So in those instances, only show me one example of your calculations and then just make tables of the rest. Since most of the rest of our lab reports this quarter will have hardly anything in the way of calculations, we won't run into that problem most likely. But those are the general comments I've seen. Some of you might have had individual things here and there. I'll again emphasize that theory is not required to be in your lab reports. So some of you put it in to try to explain what you did, and it's not wrong to put it in if you want to. But the more you say, the more that I'm grading, the more you have a chance to get off topic and maybe say something that's not quite right. So that's the only reason I'm warning you, is that if you say it, I got to read it. And that if you have a long theoretical explanation and you go a little bit wrong, well, you might end up losing a half point or something if you go off track. Questions about lab report 2? Yes?
Oh, okay. It's not lab report
2. Oh, what's your question about?
In the email?
Yes.
I email you, like, it's okay to email me the grade.
So if you did, and then I'll be responding back. But thank you for reminding me, though, because there were a few of you that didn't yet send me the message that it's okay to receive your grades by email. And so I'll just be emailing you back saying, I have your report, I have your comments ready, but please send me that message. I know I might be a little paranoid about this, but I've got reason to be. So that's lab report 2. How about what's on exam number 2? Shall we review for that? Maybe we'll do that first. So let me pull up our topic list for the last couple of weeks, and I'll walk through what we've done. There are going to be, and section 2, this will be your first time you're hearing this, and so you might go, a little bit, and I'll talk about specifically which portions. A little bit of the lecture we had on SN1 and SN2 is going to be on the exam. But there's very specific portions of it, and I'll explain where. In fact, let's just handle that first. Kinetics. In kinetics, we had discussed a number of things, including reaction coordinate diagrams, the rate limiting step, why activation energy is so important. Really, those are the three topics from kinetics I care the most about, along with the idea of the reagents in a rate law are in the rate limiting step. The whole point of covering kinetics like this wasn't just to review kinetics, and this is not Chem 1. It's because one of the fundamental topics of SN1 and SN2 reactions is what does that one mean and what does that two mean. And in a traditional approach, we don't do a review of kinetics. We just jump into the reaction. And while we're in the middle of learning that reaction, an OChem instructor would say, oh, well, by the way, there's all the stuff that you learned last year, and here's a rate limiting step, and that's why. Maybe they'll explain it more in-depthly. I'm trying an approach where we do the kinetics first, that I scare you all into going back and studying your general chem. And aside from anything to do with OChem, we try to rationalize what is the rate-limiting step. And then discussing how only those things in the rate-limiting step show up in a rate law. Now let's put the two back together again. You have seen the SN1 mechanism, and you've seen the SN2 mechanisms. You've also seen other simpler mechanisms. And so at this point, I'm just presuming that we have a little bit of proficiency in writing mechanisms. So I want you to be able to write a mechanism for an SN1 reaction and a mechanism for an SN2 reaction. I'll actually do that again right now. SN2, it is a concerted mechanism. So remember, we had this lecture on mechanisms where we talked about single electron and electron pair. We talked about cationic versus anionic versus radical. That terminology you do need to be familiar with. And one thing you could say is that this is an anionic mechanism that is concerted. And because it's concerted, and because two molecules are involved in the same time in that rate-limiting step, that's why the two is in that name. It's bimolecular nucleophilic substitution. For SN1, you're going to have at least two steps. All of the examples we've seen so far have had three, where first the bond breaks. You form a carbocation. So this is a stepwise cationic mechanism. The second step, the most common example I've done has been with water. And I've said it so many times now that this little aspect I hope you all get right, that water starts out as neutral but becomes positively charged when it forms a new bond. And so something has to give, and it's generally a hydrogen that comes off. Now, which of these three steps is the toughest? The first one, because it's a bond-breaking reaction that depends on forming a carbocation. Because there's only one molecule in that rate-limiting step, again, the connection back to kinetics. That's why this is a rate law with only one molecule in it, because only one molecule is in the rate-limiting step. So, you need to know how to draw a reaction coordinate diagram. If I were to give you enough information, it could be about any reaction I want. For example, if I say this is an endothermic process, a one-step endothermic process, you'd need to know that you'd write a diagram that looks like this. One step, endothermic. If I said you had two steps, the first of which was endothermic, the second of which was exothermic, and the overall reaction is exothermic, then you'd know that you need to be able to draw a diagram like that. On these diagrams, you'd need to be able to tell me what's the activation energy, where are the transition states. If there's multiple steps, show me all the transition states, the activation energies in the forward and reverse directions. All stuff we've done in lectures so far. But the point of that is to then discuss the rate-limiting step. So again, you need to know an SN2 mechanism and an SN1 mechanism. I might even tell you that given bromoethane and hydroxide, SN2 will occur. Write the mechanism. I might tell you that 2-bromo-2-methyl-propane reacts with an SN1 mechanism. So you don't have to know yet why would SN2 occur or why would SN1 occur yet. But you need to be explaining what the 1 and the 2 are in this reaction mechanism. Yes?
In SN2 reaction, which part is the transition? Which one is the transition?
The transition state?
Yeah.
Well, it's not written in the mechanism. Mechanisms, we don't generally show transition states.
Oh, so what will be the transition?
We haven't discussed what the structure of the transition state is yet. Actually, for an SN2 reaction, the reaction coordinate diagram would look like this. And so the transition state's always higher than the products or reactants, but we have not yet learned how to write what the molecules look like at the transition state. And what the molecules look like in the transition state is not normally written in a mechanism. So, that's for kinetics. There is this other topic. In section 1, you got this preview. Hyperconjugation. Hyperconjugation is going to be our explanation of why this tertiary carbocation formed, but a primary carbocation would not want to form. So section 1, you've already seen a comparison this morning of four molecules, tertiary, secondary, primary, and methyl carbocations. In that order, there's 3, 2, 1, and 0 hyperconjugation interactions, which is what causes tertiary carbocations to be more easily formed. Exactly what I just said is exactly the type of question about hyperconjugation that you're going to get. Now, what other topics have we had since the last exam? Well, we do have stereochemistry. And so, yes, you'll have more questions about R and S. You'll still have questions about whether something is achiral or chiral. But now you'll need to know some of this additional terminology that we covered. For example, we talked about mechanism having certain consequences, stereochemical consequences. So you should be familiar with loss, retention, and inversion of configuration. Since we had SN1 and SN2 as concrete examples of loss of configuration and inversion of configuration, then here's the extent that you need to be able to understand. In the SN2 reaction, because everything happens at once and the nucleophile attacks from behind, that's why it has inversion of configuration. Even more important than that, an easier one even to explain, is in the SN1 reaction, because you get this carbocation and it's planar, SP2 hybridized, planar, then that means attack can happen from the top or the bottom. So even if I don't ask you why is inversion happen in SN2, I could ask you why do you end up with an optically inactive solution from SN1? Optical activity is not something that was on your quiz. But you need to know what optical activity is. You need to be able, in really rough terms, explain how could you measure it. So we talked about those cross polarizers. And I de-emphasized it at the time because I was so worried about RNS and what enantiomers and all that are. But if you have questions about it, now's the perfect time to ask. Or we do have Friday's lecture where you can ask questions as well. But you do need to know what optical activity is, and you need to know what a racemic mixture is. So I probably won't ask you to draw enantiomers, diastereomers, epimers. I will still ask you what R and S are, and then I'll be focusing more on optical activity and reaction stereochemistry. The one other thing I could ask you is how to name molecules with two stereocenters. And so let me give you an example of doing that, because your last quiz only had one stereocenter on it, and I told you that we hadn't had enough practice with multiple stereocenters to name them. So let's do an example. And let's do something like this. Because we haven't talked enough about numbering cyclic compounds. You've seen some examples, I'm sure you saw them in the book, but we haven't formally gone over numbering. So, what's the most important thing on this molecule?
OH.
Alcohol is more important than any hydrocarbon, which is more important than any halogen. So the alcohol is most important, and that automatically makes it position 1. Now we have to number sequentially one way or the other around the ring, and we follow the first point of difference rule. So which direction is going to give us smaller numbers? We go counterclockwise or clockwise?
Clockwise.
So bromine's going to be at the 3 position. Even before we finish that example, let's take something like this. And this I'm showing you just so we can tackle how to number. How would we number that compound? So there are different types of substituents. Ethyl alphabetically shows up earlier than methyl, but that's not what necessarily makes us decide which way to number. Let's pick up a few scenarios, though. If I chose this methyl group over here and labeled it 1, then if I went clockwise, my next number I would run into is 3. If I went counterclockwise, the next number I would run into is 4. So out of those two directions, which one would be the better one?
Clockwise.
The first one, because at the first point of difference, the first place as I'm going around the ring, 3 is lower than 4, so I would go with 3. But that's not the lowest possible set of numbers. If I had instead started with the methyl group and called it position 1, then I could have gone one way around the ring and gotten position 3, or I'll go the other way around the ring and get position 2. Since 2 is lower than 3, that's a more correct way to do it. But if I kept numbering around the ring, I would get 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 would be my set of numbers. Well, what if I chose one more way to number? If, as someone suggested at first, I start with the ethyl group, not because E in ethyl is lower than M in methyl, but because if I give it the number 1, then if I go counterclockwise, the next position's 2, and all the way over here, that's position 4. And it's not that 1 plus 2 plus 4 itself adds up to the lowest number. No, it's that at each point along the ring, I've gotten the smallest number I can, starting with the first number. So everywhere, of course, the first number is going to be 1. Wherever you have a ring that's got a substituent, if it only has one substituent, that is number 1. But look in the first example. The next lowest number I could get was only a 3. But in either of these other two ways, the lowest number I could get is a 2. At that first point of comparison, that second substituent, since 2 is lower than 3, I go with the 2. But then I have a choice. Do I want 1, 2, 5 or 1, 2, 4? Well, 4 is lower than 5, so this bottom way is the correct way to number the ring. Yes?
So even the methyl and the ethyl, we switch it around, the number is still 1, 2, 4.
That's right. Even if I swap this methyl and ethyl group, even though E and ethyl is lower, you only look at alphabetization if you can't decide which way. Like if two ways of numbering are identical, then you look at the names of the substituents. Now back to the one I wanted you to name. Top one, RS, 2, 3. Is it? Let's see. Oxygen is 1. These next positions over are equal, so we have to go to the next one out. Bromine's more important than carbon, so yes. 1, 2, 3, clockwise, R. Bottom one, R or S?
R.
That was fast. You knew it was coming, right? So bromine is importance number 1. Then we have the two directions of the ring again. Again, if I go out, the right side is more important than the left. So 1, 2, 3. It looks S, but it really is R because the least important group is pointing at you. You all did some practice after that quiz, didn't you? Okay, good. Yes? Because an alcohol functional group is more important than any hydrocarbon, which is more important than any halogen. Yes? Yes. Functional group priorities. Alcohols, out of all the functional groups that we've really done any naming with, alcohols are more important. Then you have alkenes and alkynes. Then you have alkanes. Then you have halogens. So to finish off this name, we have the bromine, which would have the bromo substituent name. So this would be 3-bromo cyclo hexanol. Notice I didn't put a number on the alcohol. Why? Because for rings, you leave the number out as long as it's obvious where that position's going to be. Since only one functional group is the important functional group, there's only one alcohol, you don't need to give the number. But we have stereocenters. If you only have one stereocenter, you don't use numbers with it. If you have multiple stereocenters, you must use numbers. When we're naming stereocenters, we go just in numerical order. And so the first stereocenter is located at position 1. That's an R. The second position is 3, and it's also R. So this compound is 1R3R3 bromocyclohexanol. Questions about that problem? Yes. Doesn't matter. Just you name by the number.
By the number, not by the letter.
No, right. By the number, not by the letter. All right. That's right. So again, ones, twos, three, four, five. You can do it in the number order. Yes.
If we have R and S and E and Z, which one is more important?
They all can go in the same parentheses. So you just, again, list them by number. The question was, what if you have E and Z? Because this morning we reviewed alkenes, which alkene naming is not on the exam. But to answer the question, you just do it in numerical order still. All right, now let's see what other topics we've got. So we covered mechanism, which the mechanism portion of the test is going to be writing out the SN1 and SN2 mechanisms, knowing how these labels of stepwise and concerted and cationic and anionic would apply. For thermodynamics, mainly it's to lead up to reaction coordinate diagrams. To everybody's relief, probably, I'm not going to ask you what enthalpy is. But I am going to ask you what a state function is. And I'll ask you what is a state function and why is it important that enthalpy is a state function. To help answer that question and to wrap up one small part of kinetics we didn't get to. Here's a reaction coordinate diagram for a reaction. How many reagents are in the rate law for this reaction?
One.
That's exactly the point. Just because you see a diagram and know it's one step, you have no idea how many reagents are involved. You have to know what the mechanism is to come up with the number of reagents in the rate limiting step. But that's not really what I'm going to get at. How would this change if I put in a catalyst? Which, for those of you who are in 1B, you know that I went on this long tangent about this answer. It lowers the activation energy. But no, it does, yes, but not really. Because it's a different reaction when you put a catalyst in. It can have multiple steps. So I realize it might be a really petty point of semantics, but it doesn't just lower the activation barrier, it gives a whole new reaction pathway. The activation barrier in that new pathway is lower in energy than the original one, which if you're at the same temperature and you're knowing steric effects, then that means it's going to have a faster rate of reaction. So catalyzed, yes, the simple answer, it's lower activation energy. But more important to show is that it's a different reaction path. So I'll say it this way. A catalyst lowers the activation energy for a reaction by giving a new reaction pathway. But what happened to the energies of the products and reactants? They have to be the same, because Hess's law tells you that it doesn't matter how a reaction occurs, the enthalpy change just depends on the reactants and products. So what does a catalyst do to equilibrium? Doesn't do a thing. It lets you reach equilibrium more quickly, but it doesn't change equilibrium, because equilibrium depends on the energy difference between products and reactants. And if a catalyst doesn't change that because of Hess's law, then a catalyst doesn't change K. A catalyst does not affect equilibrium. So from thermodynamics, you need to know what Hess's law is. From kinetics, reaction coordinate diagrams, including this little bit I just threw in about catalysis. Why? Because that's connected to Hess's law. It's an example of how Hess's law trumps what's going on in a reaction. You can provide multiple pathways, but the energy change is still the same. What do you have to know about equilibrium? I want you to be able to explain equilibrium according to these three definitions, which are concentration, rate, and energy. That the concentrations of products and reactants appears constant, that the rates of the forward and reverse reactions are equal, and that you're at the lowest point of energy in the system, and because of that, energy's not changing. You need to be also describe Le Chatelier's principle. And it will be for a specific example, which we're going to start today, because we are going to move now into acids and bases. We won't finish today, but I think it was important that we did this review. So I think you can forgive that we might have to wrap this up on Friday, because at least you now know what the rest of the test is going to be. Let me make sure there aren't any important other topics that we need to review. I always seem to manage to leave one out. Oh, of course. So before we... What? I would have realized as soon as I reviewed this anyways. What? It's on the syllabus. We covered it. Therefore, it's testable. Just because it may not be your favorite topic doesn't mean that we don't put it on the exam. And we've had two lectures where conjugation has come up. The one back when we did SN1, SN2, and the one we just had on Monday. So even if you ignored the SN1, SN2 lecture, we did come back to it in lecture on Monday. Right? What kind of question would I ask you? To draw a smog diagram for that. Because the only way you could draw a smog diagram for something like that, now, realize I'm writing the test in front of you, and I may choose a different molecule than this. But I might not, because the important thing about this is that if you look at that and you don't know what resonance structures are and you don't know what delocalization is, you'll go sp2, sp2, sp3, and you'll get the wrong smog diagram. And that's the point. All the carbons there are sp2 because of delocalization. And why can't we see this in the structure? Because resonance structures can't show the true structure of a molecule. There's the answer for the question I'll ask you. Wow. You could just repeat it over and over on your iPod after I'm done. Yes.
If you use another Kanban, what will it be?
It'll be something where I can get at exactly this situation, where what looks like hybridization is wrong if you don't know that resonance is occurring. Now, let's get to acids and bases. Now, this Le Chatelier's principle thing, how am I going to tie that into acids and bases? Let's just jump right in the middle. What's a weak acid? So what's delta G for the dissociation of a weak acid?
Endogonic,
which means that for weak acid dissociation, you could draw a reaction progress diagram that looks like this. This is a likely reaction progress diagram for the dissociation of a weak acid. Why? Because weak acid is an acid that only minimally dissociates. We could take a generalized acid, HA, and show it splitting up into H plus and A minus. That process we can write an equilibrium constant for, which we call KA, which is products over reactants raised to their stoichiometric coefficients. Which for a monoprotic acid means one which only one proton comes off, it's a pretty simple expression. If you don't get much dissociation, you don't get much products. If you don't get much products, K is small. K is mathematically linked to free energy. So if you have a small K, you have a positive free energy, because really tiny, like less than 1 K, log of something less than 1 is a negative number. A negative of a negative number is a positive value. A positive delta G is an endergonic reaction, which means that at equilibrium, it wants to lie mostly towards reactants, which means the acid doesn't want to dissociate. I said the same thing, just in a multiple different ways. So, what happens if we neutralize this with a strong base?
Normally, a strong acid would have a weak conjugate base.
That's right. And if this is a weak acid, and we force it to react with a base, what's going to result? Well, buffer is a situation where you've got both acid and base balancing each other. If we force it to be completely neutralized, and what I'm getting at, and Chem 1 students that had me in the past, remember the big long lecture we had about neutral is not the same thing as neutralized?
Oh,
yeah. If I gave you an acidic solution made up of a weak acid, and I take exactly the number of moles of base needed to exactly neutralize that acid, what will the pH of the solution be? It can't be 7, because if you force this to completely dissociate, you are getting rid of all the reactants and you're making just products. Your Q will be far past equilibrium. If you're sitting around in solution then with just this conjugate base, it's going to be reacting with anything it can, including the water in a solution if we're assuming an aqueous environment. It'll even react with that water so that it could go back down energetically to re-reach equilibrium. So if you had a dissociation of an acid, which doesn't want to go that far, and you disturb the equilibrium by adding a base, there's the Le Chatelier's part, you force that proton off. You force it to become a product when it doesn't want to. Well, Le Chatelier's principle says it's going to go right back and try to respond to that stress, which means it's going to try to take a proton from wherever it can, including the solution it's in. When that happens, it's going to make the solution basic. This, what I just blurted out in 2 minutes here, is what we're going to talk about today and half of Friday then. Let me develop this exact example further, because this really explains why acids and bases, they have their conjugate strengths the way they do, because it's related to delta G. I got to back up, though, and give us a little terminology. First of all, what is neutral? What is the definition of neutral? No. No. Why can pH 7 not be defined as neutral? Because it depends on temperature. Why is pH 7 called neutral?
Because of the water.
Because of auto-ionization of water. Which means water breaking up to become H plus and OH minus. Is that a favorable reaction?
No.
Why does it happen?
Delta G.
Because some of the molecules have enough energy to be able to see that same explanation that you're going to hear over and over and over again. Some of the molecules have enough energy to be able to disassociate. So this is unfavorable, but some molecules have enough energy to dissociate. At room temperature, you get a concentration of 1.00 times 10 to the negative 7 molar for H plus concentration. We have this function pH, which is defined as the negative base 10 log of the concentration of H plus. And in this case, it equals 7 for pure water at 25 degrees Celsius, roughly.
But what if we change temperature? Well, then we change the fraction of molecules that have that energy to dissociate.
And so you change the H plus concentration. So pH 7 as neutral is only true at one temperature. And if you did any experiment with the pH probes, if you were students here, you might remember you had to put the temperature in your pH probes to get the right results, exactly for this reason. So we can't make a definition of neutral based off of pH because pH is variable. So let's try another one. What is the definition of neutral? Why? Because when water dissociates, you make equal moles of H plus and OH minus. So that right there is the definition of neutral. Neutral is when the concentration of H plus is equal to the concentration of OH minus. What is neutralized? And don't tell me it's when the solution is neutral. Of what, though?
Okay, so there's an uneven amount of pass through.
Right. So it has nothing to do with H plus and OH minus. It's when, like, you're both saying different aspects of the same thing. It's when moles of acid that you've added to the solution equal to moles base. The big question that we're going to use the Chatelier's principle to explain is why is neutral not the same thing as neutralized. And again, and I'll give you the answer again in the 2 minutes we got left, and then this is the spillover into Friday, what we're going to have to finish wrapping up. Because Friday's lecture isn't actually going to take long for the topic it's supposed to be on Friday. You'll see like an afterthought after all this, in fact. If you throw in equal moles of acid and base, and this one, actually, I won't write this part down because I'm going to write it down more carefully Friday. Here's a weak acid. Here's a strong base. One mole of acid, one mole of base, they will neutralize. They will react. But if that base pulls off all the protons of that weak acid, you've pushed the equilibrium of that weak acid all the way to the right where it doesn't want to be. Again, that equilibrium will try to shift back, reestablish equilibrium. And the only way it has to do that is to pull protons back off of whatever just removed them. So after you've added equal moles of acid and base, you don't have a complete reaction. It's a lie we teach you in 1A because could you handle all of this in 1A?
Oh, how dare you?
What?
It's all lies.
Of course it's all lies.
Is it a lie?
Yes. Until we figure out a deeper truth underneath it. That's how science works, right? I mean, think about when you learn what an atom is. An atom is this thing that's got little planets going around it.
It's a lie.
Until you find out, no, it's quantum mechanics. Until you find out, no, it's string theory. Until you find out, no, there's this new theory, you know?
It's a lie.
So, anyways, the end of the story is that because that pullback is going to happen, because it tries to reestablish equilibrium, you won't have equal amount of H plus and OH minus. So neutralized is not neutral. We'll finish this on Friday.